Simply Focus mit Elva Czerny and Dominic Gilda for Live and Joy and Tea.
We've got a brand new exciting episode for you. Please welcome your hosts, Elva Czerny and Dominic Godad.
Thank you very much, Ken, and a joyful hello to everyone from Las Vegas.
We are here at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and we're right very close to the Strip. We can even see the casinos here.
We are sitting in Sarah Smuck-Jordan's office right now, and we are so happy to have you here today. Thank you very much, Sarah, and welcome.
Thank you for having me.
It's a great pleasure and honor for us. For those who don't know Sarah yet, you might have heard of her in the podcast with Johnny Kim.
And actually, Sarah and her family are with us for quite a while. The first time when we came to Vancouver Island and visited Jen Bevelus, she told us, you know, Sarah was here with her family and they came with their trailer and you can go to the campground where they were, and just wrote them an email, and well, there we went. We stayed on the campground where you stayed, and a few months later we visited Heather Fisk, where we also heard great stories from you and your family, and we are really happy to get to know you. You have two wonderful, amazing boys and one wonderful, amazing daughter and a wonderful husband as well. So thank you very much for introducing us to Las Vegas in a very different way than most people get introduced to Las Vegas. And of course, we are very much looking forward to talking to you today about microanalysis, about research, about training, education in the field of solution focus.
You met solution focus in 2001, 2002. You were at the right place at the right time and met Steve DeShazer, Insu Kimberg at Purdue. And ever since, you've been with solution focus. Sarah Smuck-Jordan has done a lot of work in microanalysis, a lot of research work. We're here at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. You're an associate professor and our program director of couple and family therapy. So you did so many things in this field, and we're very, very happy and very curious to hear more about that from you.
So Sarah, what fascinates you about solution focus?
That's a great question. Thanks again for having me. As a master's student, I remember the first class that I took was a theories class on postmodern theories, and we read Steve's work. And I remember it was the first book in my life where I got my highlighter out and I highlighted like every sentence in the whole book. And I knew, this is something I like. And I started seeing clients that semester, and I noticed right away, I started asking solution-oriented, solution-focused questions. And I never turned back.
So what fascinated you back then, and what is it that fascinates you today?
I think originally when I was reading Steve's work, and it was about this belief in people and these values and beliefs about humankind and about people had all the resources that they needed, and it was so refreshing and it resonated with me as a person. And I wanted to learn how to do it because I believed in the principles and the tenets of what he was writing about. And so why I keep doing it is the more I do it, the more I enjoy it, the more I learn, the more other people enjoy the model and learn about the model. And it's contagious, right? And once you have a good experience with it, you want to continue to have those experiences.
That's beautiful.
And you did so many things. You were on the board of the SFBTA for many years. You are part of the International Microanalysis Associates and are into microanalysis and analyzing the miracle question with Peter DeYoung and Sarah Healing and Jennifer Gerving at the moment. So many things that you do, many publications. What is it that fascinates you with microanalysis?
So I'll start when I went to meet Jan for the first time. And I had been to a conference in November and I met Jan, and she had been there before, but I didn't get introduced to her at that time. And so someone encouraged me to go up and talk to her, and her and Harry Corman had just done a plenary. And I was just fascinated by the detail and watching change happen moment by moment. And I thought, I want to learn how to do this. And so I went up to Jan and I said, would you mind if I was a new professor and had some startup money, could I come visit you? Could learn about this? And she said, sure. And 2 months later, I was there. And I had gone in with this idea that I would go and we would start this project and we'd have it all laid out. And it would be very productive and we would do all these things. And I remember going to Jan's place, and first thing she did was had me sit down in a chair at her computer and said, here's some videos. I want you to watch them and tell me what you like and what you're interested in. And I thought, really? Okay. So like all day I watched these videos and I thought, there's got to be more. I know there's more to this. But it was still very fascinating. And I ended up watching a video with Carl Rogers, and the client was very happy and smiling. It's a very old video. And she went from laughing and smiling to crying based on what he said to her. She drastically changed her affect. And I remember saying to Jan, this is what I'm interested in. What happened here? She was doing great. And then all of a sudden she wasn't. And what did he say? And how did he say it? And how does this happen in a session where clients can be positive and future focused and shift, or vice versa, be problem focused and shift into a solution focus frame? And so I said, that's what I'm interested in. And we started talking more about this, and we ended up just beginning a project where we looked at positive and negative content. Although I was interested in much more than just what was being said, I thought that was kind of the beginning to figure out, how do we capture solution focused brief therapy in an observable way? And I thought microanalysis was a great way to do that. So I came back to Texas and I had a graduate student, Adam Froer, and I said, let's start this project and work on it with Jan. And he was excited and she was committed to doing this work. So we met every week for 2 hours on Skype, and I took notes because I wanted to remember everything for probably a year and a half. I took notes and we started this project, and it was an amazing experience. And I thought, I'll never do any other kind of research again if I can help it, because this is my favorite. It's a lot of work, but I'm up for that. It's different. It's unique. I can see things that others might not see if they're watching the same video.
And the research you just mentioned with positive negative content has been very influential. All the listeners who have heard of the quadrants, for example, that Haesan Moon introduced, or all the listeners who have listened to the first few podcasts that Elfie and I did, where we talked about how to formulate questions or what we listen for, you will find this research very influential in what the way you see differences in what you pick out, and then how our clients or our conversation partners respond to that and how we respond again.
And yet I'm very curious to hear from you, what were your findings in this research and what fascinated you with these findings?
Well, one of the first things that we looked at was, well, we compared solution-focused brief therapy experts to cognitive behavioral experts, because CBT is thought by many to be an evidence-based practice and widely used in lots of areas. And being interested in evidence-based practice, I wanted to compare what we did with another approach that was highly regarded all over the world. And so one of the things that we found is that solution-focused therapists, regardless of the practitioner, tend to be more positive in the content that they use versus negative, but they're not all positive. And I think that's a myth of solution-focused brief therapy, is that we only say positive things, and that's not what we do, and we do acknowledge the problem, and so we found evidence of that. The other thing that we found that was really interesting is that the results of the amount of positive, negative, neither negative or positive content was more similar amongst solution-focused therapists than cognitive behavioral therapists, that they had more variation between their approaches, which is interesting from a scientific perspective, that a model that even though has lots of variations of CBT is not as similar amongst the people that are using it. So that was very interesting. Then we were interested about, kind of going back to the original reason why I did the study, was how does the client respond immediately in kind to the therapist? And we found that what a therapist says has an immediate effect on the client. So if a therapist says something positive, the client is statistically significantly more likely to respond with something positive. And the same if a therapist says something negative. We found that true in all six of our sessions that we looked at. Jan also told me when we were starting this study that was one of the larger studies, because usually they look at small segments of a few tapes, where we looked at the entire session of six full-length sessions, which is a lot. I think it took almost a year to analyze all that data. So it was a good learning experience, but also I think it was really important because I was interested over the course of the session if things changed, if things got more positive or negative or stayed pretty much the same. So those were some of the findings that we came up with.
And now you're looking at the miracle question with Peter Young. So what are you doing there, and how might that be useful for practitioners in the future?
That's a great question. So last fall I was on sabbatical and I went to Vancouver Island and spent time with Jan, and we have this new analysis that we originally had developed as grounding and now we're calling calibration. It's much more sophisticated. complicated. And I went there to learn hands-on how to use the manual to do the analysis. And as we were looking at lab data of conversations, we noticed many things, but I wanted to, of course, apply it to solution-focused conversations. So upon arriving back, and Peter had visited as well, spent some time with Jan, and we talked about what would be a very specific conversation within the dialogue that we could look at to see what happens moment by moment as we ground. And we thought, well, the miracle question would be great because everyone's going to start out the miracle question very similarly and ask things very detailed and ask for preferred future and evidence of that. So we were kind of curious how the preferred future developed over the course of answering the miracle question. So right now we're towards the end of that analysis. It's taken us several months, but we've already picked up and made notes on several little nuances about how a client responds and even the tense of the language. How would you know? How did you know? How will you know? And in kind of going back and forth a bit. And that's been very interesting so far, but we haven't really looked at the overall what has happened. I do think that the miracle question and the answer in response to that is very different from other questions that we ask in session. And I know that there are lots of thoughts about whether to ask the miracle question or not. And so I'm hoping that we find some information about what is different or unique about the miracle question or the responses to that question and how those pieces are put in place over time versus other future-oriented questions. So at SFBTA, actually during our research meeting, I had this thought of once we're done with this analysis, of course, it would be nice to compare it to other future-like oriented questions and what's the difference and how do we ground? Do we ground sooner or longer? Do we gather more detail or less detail? So that I'm already thinking to the next project, of course, but I think it would be very interesting because what we do is we record observable behavior. And so there's no better way, I think, to teach and train students how to do something than to actually show them what other people are doing and then have them watch their own work to see what they're doing.
When you say having your students watching their own work and showing them other tapes, how do you do that exactly? And what differences does solution focus make in your work with the students and in analyzing the tapes there?
You know, microanalysis is a very rigorous scientific methodology, but pieces of it can be used not only in everyday life, but with teaching and training. And so over the years and at different times and different ways, I've had students pick out parts of their video to watch and to show me parts that they've done well. And then we will slow it down and we will look at what they're doing, what the therapist does, what the client does, how they know that that piece of the session went well, and to go from there. And a lot of times in supervision, students are reluctant to bring film because they don't want to be under a microscope. They don't want to be told they're not doing something right. So when I ask them to bring a piece, a minute, 30 seconds, where they feel like something went well, they seem much more comfortable with that. And when they start watching themselves over and over in the same segment of the tape, they notice those little things that they're doing. And they said this, and the client said this, and then they said this in response. And training students in the model using this idea of listen, select, build, I think plays into this as well, because it is that moment-by-moment exchange. And the fact that we can observe that and use those skills from research to help train students observe what they notice is going well and then how the client responds, since we do know that that makes a difference.
And when we did the microanalysis course and you guys tortured us, especially with one CBT video and then a solution-focused video, and we had to look at the choices that the therapist made, kind of topic choice, really it hurt to watch the CBT video, and it was such a relief to watch the solution-focused video. So it's very clear, it's kind of, you know it when you see it, and it's very clear what happens. How is that for your students? Because you not only train them in solution-focused, but also other methodologies. How do they see those differences?
That's a great question, and I think being in a university setting, it is unique as a trainer, because I'm training students and teaching them in lots of different models, depending on their interest and what the requirements for the program are. The nice thing is the pieces of microanalysis that I use to train solution focus can also be used to teach students another model. So asking them what went well, what did you do, what did the client do in response, how does your behavior match what you think that you're doing or what your philosophy is about change, what your thoughts are about the therapeutic conversation. And so I think it's wonderful because it can be applied to any model, any student, any situation. And I think students are relieved when they do have me for practicum, and if they don't like solution focus, they're like, oh, okay, so we can get something that we want besides this. And I think that's a misconception with solution focus educators, is that that we're going to force them to do something they don't want to do, and that's not solution focused. So it's nice to use solution focused dialogue as well as aspects of microanalysis to teach and train students to be the best that they can be so that their best hopes can be accomplished. So my main interest in microanalysis, and when I was introduced to it, is that it would be a way to capture behaviorally what is going on in a session and what the similarities are and the differences are between doing solution focused and not doing solution focused, and personal differences in therapist. There are a lot of great solution focused therapists, but they have different nuances, their personality, how they phrase things slightly, but there are also commonalities. And so really capturing where the personal differences in terms of who they are as a person and how they are in the room with doing the model in an attempt to train students how to do it.
And just the other day, we were here and had the pleasure of working with some of your students. And it was amazing to hear those stories and the differences the video analysis makes for them and how fast and well they learn with that.
I remember when I was at Purdue and I first met Steve and later met Insu, and we started having these meetings. His main purpose of having those initial meetings was to better teach and train practitioners. He shared with us that there were so many misconceptions about the model and so many people training clinicians to use solution-focused therapy in a technique sort of frame, and he really wanted to get away from that. And that had been my initial experience with the model, is that it was about you ask these questions and have these interventions. And I think we've made great strides over the years to capture what solution-focused therapists do in the conversation and to clarify it so that new practitioners and students can more quickly learn how to do the model. So I'm thinking of an example with some of the students that you met with the other day. And there's a research project here that we're going to do on campus where they're going to be using solution-focused therapy. And they had learned about solution-focused therapy, but they really needed a more in-depth training. And so I met with them in a group for several weeks, several hours, and we talked about the process of the model, and we watched a video, and we stopped it, and we went moment by moment. And they were able to connect the pieces of, oh, so this is what it looks like. This is how you do it. This is not just about asking this question or doing this intervention. And I think the work with microanalysis and the research that we've generated is to more quickly get people to the point where they understand it's about dialogue, it's about a conversation. These are the elements or ingredients. Listening is part of this equation, this listen, select, build process. And while it's simple, it's not easy.
So what else did your students take away from that, and what differences did these weeks of meeting make for them in a sense that was observable for you?
That's a great question. What I did is I used a framework from a course that was developed from Interviewing for Solutions to really think about the elements that we wanted to cover in a certain amount of time. And what I noticed from students is that they were having these aha moments, and that they were talking about how this was more clear now than it used to be. And it wasn't that they didn't have exposure to the model before, but especially watching the video was very helpful, that we would talk about a concept and they would ask questions, and then we would watch it and they would say, well, what happens when somebody says this and what happens when somebody says that? And there are some ways that I can respond, and I did respond, but also teaching them that it's about the context and what's going on in that current moment. And I think for students learning to do therapy, but specifically a model that they're learning, they really want to know, what do I do? What's the right way? Tell me how to do it. And balancing that with giving them information, but also letting them practice and talk about those things themselves. When I've taught this course in the past on solution-focused brief therapy, there would be a didactic piece. There is an observation piece where they watch video, we talk about it, and then they actually do exercises and have conversations about the concepts that we're talking about. And it would build from basic theoretical components and assumptions about conversation and co-construction and post-structural, and then we actually starting the conversation. So how you start the dialogue, what are the best ways to begin a conversation so that it gets off on the right foot? And so we sort of build from there. So what's an opening question? And then based on what the client says, where do you go from there? And so each week we would build. But the important part, I think, is that they would get to practice. Then I would either watch live or from a video recording, because there were several of them, and then give them feedback. This is what I noticed that you did behaviorally. And I would say, this is the question you asked. It wasn't general, like, oh, you did a good job, that's fine. Because to me, that's not very helpful if I was the student, in my experience. And so again, it goes back to those details of observable behavior. You said this question. These are the assumptions in this question. This is how this question fits with the model. And I think, again, a combination of reading, having a conversation about the material, watching someone else do these things, practicing them themselves, and then getting feedback on what was observed from what they did, I think really kind of closes the loop in that piece.
And solution focus is so much about also monitoring progress. So what do you see them do differently now than to a few months or weeks before?
That official study hasn't started yet. However, I've noticed changes in our conversations. I've noticed that these students would have come to the conference this year and have noticed that we would talk about something pertaining to solution building, solution focus, co-construction, and they would know exactly what I was talking about. They've had this experience of interacting in a different way. To me, that's evidence. Versus just talking about concepts or them saying, oh, I asked this question or asked a scaling question, that they were actually talking about the components of listen, select, build.
And it makes such a difference to teach in such a way compared to just take a textbook and then let them do what is in the textbook and learn from a textbook version. Just really let them observe their own work and analyze that and let them observe other people and learn from that. That's what we realized when we did our leadership trainings, that learning is so much faster when they can really see it, and so much easier to, well, I could say, to understand what they're doing.
And I think that part of at least training therapists in general, a big obstacle that we have is that we have certain courses that we have to teach on theory, and then we have practicum, but they're very separate. At least in our field, they're not integrated as well. So you learn a topic in this class, and then you have a faculty member, a professor in practicum who is doing something very different and observing your work, and there's a big disconnect. And I think it has to educationally all fit together. Not only do people learn from different styles, but to fully integrate this into a dialogue, into a conversation, you need to understand the concepts. You need to see it behaviorally occurring. And then you need to do it, but also need the feedback. I know as a student, sometimes in certain classes, I was asked to demonstrate things. And then the feedback was very general, which wasn't as helpful to me because I didn't know if I was doing what I was, quote, supposed to do. And so I think the detailed feedback back to the student is just as important as their observation of themselves or their observation of watching somebody else do the model. You were asking about what else I've noticed. I've also noticed that the more the students learn and practice, the more excited they become. They start smiling. They're like, oh, I can't wait to do this. Or I have this client. I'm going to try it out at 4 o'clock today and see what happens. I'm going to have this different conversation with them. And that's what I notice. I notice people coming back and being excited. And so that's how I can tell, hopefully, that I'm helping them learn in this process, is that they're getting it in that way, that it makes sense, that it clicks, that they're excited, that it works for them. As an educator, that's probably the most rewarding part of the process.
Yeah, I love that. And talking about education, talking about training, and also talking about research, this was also something we talked about with Johnny Kim in our podcast a few weeks ago, how important it is to see what we do in our trainings, especially when it comes to do research later, that you know where the solution-focused practitioners are, what kind of training did they receive, and how do they apply solution focus. And there are so many different ways of applying solution focus, and we can see that just in our answers to the question, what fascinates you with solution focus, that there are so many different aspects of what fascinates people, and that of course also influences the way they work. So I'm really curious about what you learned when it comes to training solution focus along your way, and especially also in combination with microanalysis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think microanalysis is a big part of that. Having met Jan early in my career, the first year I started as an assistant professor, was invaluable to me because it totally changed the teaching experience that I'd had up to that point. point. I can't imagine teaching how to use a model or specifically solution-focused brief therapy in any other way. Having the opportunity to have students observe video of experts and of their work and making notes and observing what they're doing well. In my practicum, regardless of the student's approach, I said, you need to find an expert in that approach and you need to watch them and watch them over and over and over and over again and notice what they're doing. And then watch yourself over and over and over again and notice what you're doing. And I understand with a lot of our students that their goal is not to be a purist. Their goal is not to, whether it's solution focused or something else, but their goal is to learn how to have effective conversations. And effective conversations can happen in a lot of different ways. For me, it's having solution focused conversations with my clients, but I also honor that others have different approaches. And so microanalysis has been such a key piece because it fits with whatever the best hopes are for that student or for that trainee. So an integration of that, as well as if you're teaching people how to do therapy, you should also do research on how to do therapy. And I think at least in our field, there's a disconnect there too. Not only the educational piece, but the research piece. Researching people's experiences or how they might answer on a questionnaire is important and valuable. But if we're training therapists, it's really important to have all aspects of observing what's going on and what they're doing and what experts are doing and what do they want to do differently? What do they feel like is more effective? What's useful? And helping them identify those key moments in the session or behavioral changes in the session. I think that takes some training. It takes experience to watch things over and over and to notice something's different there. Something shifted. What happened? And then to look at what immediately preceded that, I think is very helpful in an educational as well as a training setting as well.
How else could educators who have not yet been into microanalysis that deep? You told us the story of your last 10, 11 years with microanalysis and also very sophisticated analysis of calibration, for example, that you have to do for many, many, well, I could say months or years to really grab everything. But how could educators without that knowledge benefit from microanalysis in their way of educating solution-focused practitioners?
That's a great question. And Jan has talked about this on other occasions about using aspects of the methodology. And I think the first one comes to like what my experience was, sit down and watch some video, whether it's your video or someone you admired that does therapy or both, just what interests you. And so having educators encourage their students to do that, to do it for their own work, to do it to observe other people's therapy that they admire or even other conversations. It doesn't have to be a therapeutic conversation necessarily. We co-construct and ground and calibrate in all conversations, and it's a natural part of what we do. So I think for trainers and educators, we need to be more focused on watching video, noticing what is interesting, and not glossing over. I think our society, we go so fast and, oh, we'll just watch this in 10, 15 minutes until it's done. I'm talking about methodically watching something over and over and over again. That's how we will get the detail and notice those slight differences, because often they're very slight and they don't even have to be verbal. They can be a shift in gaze. It could be a smile. It could be a posture change that would give indication that something has shifted in the session. It's kind of an age-old question about mechanisms of behavior change or how does behavior actually change in session. And I think we have to train ourselves to watch closely video because that's the only mechanism we have for watching these things at the very precise moment and watching them over and over to notice what is different and when something does change. And change is very vague. Change could be in a helpful way or in a not helpful way. And I think it's as important to observe unhelpful changes, perhaps, as helpful. For example, when training clinicians, I always tell them if you ask a question the client says they don't know, it's helpful to stay with them and say, yes, that is a hard question, or who else would notice, or what would your partner say? But sometimes it means we've gone too fast. And so we have to definitely respond to the client in a way that goes at their speed and uses their language. And sometimes we have to slow down and we have to reconsider our next question or statement.
When you say look at video closely, it's really the observable behavior and the interactional aspects of those things, not looking into people or kind of assuming, but really watching and observing what you see.
Yes, that's a really good point. I think that's another lesson for microanalysis, is there's no way for, even if we're analyzing or watching our own video, we don't know in that exact moment what we were thinking. I mean, maybe if it was an extreme case, but that's very unlikely. And how accurate, and it's a perception. And so we are looking at at what's going on in dialogue, what's said and what's not said, what reactions and responses are made.
Sarah, from your journey, from your solution-focused journey, from your journey as a researcher, from your journey working with microanalysis and your passion for solution focus in everything you do, in all your conversations, if there's one thing that was really important for you and you think this might be also important for others on their journey, what could that be?
I think from my experience to this point, it's important to slow down and really think carefully about what we would like, what we need, what we want. If it is to learn solution-focused brief therapy, it's okay. The first thing I need to do is start reading about it. Then I need to watch videos on it. Then I need to try it. Then I need feedback about what I'm trying to do. And then I need to go back again and start all over. And so I think just this, in terms of teaching it, would be really this process of going back and forth between different mediums, but mainly watching video and watching the detail and noticing that and watching it with someone else and see what they notice and what's interesting and what patterns come up and what's there and what's not there. I think what's not there is just as important as what's there and can give us information. As a researcher, I want to be a researcher who really integrates not only what I'm interested in, but what's helpful for others. So this whole idea of evidence-based practice really emerges from being in a society where evidence is important. And whether we think research is important or not, at some level it is. And if we can show that something is helpful, then it could be helpful to someone else. I just thought of an example. I had a conversation with one of my former students today, and he was telling me about a situation in which he was inquiring about a specific job. And in that job interview, I guess, per se, the interviewer asked, well, what if you couldn't use solution-focused therapy? What if you had to use something else? And he said, well, it'd be a learning experience, but I'd really like you to show me the evidence about what else could be helpful for this particular population, because I just got this article and, you know, it was applying it in medical settings. And he says, there's this meta-analysis. And he was educating the person interviewing him about the evidence there. So I think it's important because we have to, like, and Sue says, we have to speak French. If who we're working for or who we're getting paid to do these services requires evidence, we have to produce that. And so whether we like research or not, I think all practitioners and all trainers need to be aware of that. I was told, I didn't hear it in person, but the NSU said, we just need this book that we can slam on the table and say, look, there's evidence that it's effective. And so I hope in my career, I'm part of that journey that helps provide that evidence to not only legitimize what we do, because I believe in it, but also to help people learn what we do in a more effective and timely way.
Oh, and that's what you surely are already. I mean, it's like also with Johnny Kim, we talked about evidence-based a lot, and he mentioned that the two of you really put in a lot of effort making solution-focused and evidence-based approach here in the United States. So thank you very much for that.
Yeah, so let's come to the challenge of the week.
So thinking about what we've talked about today and what might be helpful, we've talked about microanalysis and training and research and teaching and a lot of different things. I think I would challenge, and maybe this has come up before, but maybe in a different way, I would challenge you to really think about where you are right now, what you're doing well, but what you like to do a little bit different or a little bit better. And because I think video is so important, I would like you to maybe have a conversation with a friend or a colleague about this difference that you would like and what it would look like and all those details and kinds of conversations that we're used to having, and record it in some way to keep it, to remember it, and then to also review it and to look at it and to say, okay, so, you know, at this date and this time, these were my best hopes. This is what I wanted. And looking at it in a week, in a month, and noticing different things 2 months down the road in that conversation that you didn't notice the day after, and noticing how those differences that you observed 2 months down the road made a difference in your current life and what you were already doing and what you've already accomplished. And so I think that would be my challenge.
So let's go and make a video.
Yeah, thank you very, very much, Sarah. This is a very inspiring challenge and something we didn't have before. So thank you very much. Well, and of course, we are very, very, very curious now. What inspired you about our conversation with Sarah, and also how this challenge works for you? And we are not only excited to hear from you how the recording worked for you, but maybe also in a few months what differences this recording made for you. So please let us know and comment on our website on www.sfontour.com patreon.com/simplyfocuspodcast and then go to episode number 44.
And of course, you'll find all the resources we mentioned in this podcast in the resource section of this podcast. So thank you again for having us. Thank you again for spending the time with us, with your family, for spending Christmas with us, for going skating and doing all those fun things next to very cool conversations about solution focus and microanalysis and all the things we are so passionate about.
Thank you very much. It's been very exciting to get to know both of you and your whole family, and this has been a wonderful experience.
Totally likewise. Thank you, Sarah. And have a wonderful day, everyone.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Woo!
Do you like the Simply Focus podcast? Well, help Elfie and Dominic spread the word. Give the Simply Focus podcast an excellent rating on iTunes and Google Play and other platforms. Then don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. And share your thoughts and inspirations with others by commenting at www.sfontour.com/simplyfocuspodcast. Then go to this episode. This was the Simply Focus podcast with Elfie Cherney and Dominic Odat. Your podcast for a life in joy and ease.